When I think about this case now, my main thoughts are trying to find a way to bring Kristen home. We've worked some new information in the last few months, and obviously haven't found her. You know, it's frustrating to think and know that a family is withholding her body for some reason when there's no real anything to gain anymore to continue to hold the body. And so there's times when it's very, very frustrating. We have approximately 40 confirmed unsolved homicides in our county, mostly from the 70s, 80s, and 90s. That's my primary assignment, along with the additional case of the investigation of the Kristen Smart case. The Kristen Smart case was never a cold case. It was always active and being investigated once we took it over in 1996 by a detective. The detective that had it prior to me promoted in 2017, and the sheriff wanted somebody that he could dedicate to the case who had the time, and the best position was for my unsolved position. And so the sheriff assigned the Kristen Smart case to me in September of 2017.
This case has been part of the fabric of the San Luis Obispo community since it really happened. You can't really walk into a business or walk outside without someone knowing about the case and knowing the impact. It's been kind of this haunting mystery that's been in the county since 1996 when Kristen first went missing. My name is Chloe Jones. I have been a journalist for quite a while in my career, and I was the courts and crime reporter for the San Luis Obispo Tribune during the Kristen Smart murder trial. I joined the San Luis Obispo Tribune right around the time after the preliminary hearing in the case ended, and my very first hearing that I covered in the case was actually my first week of work, where the defense was trying to get the case dismissed, and that motion was unsuccessful.
Yeah, it's interesting when I look back. You know, obviously in 1996, I was a young patrol deputy working down in the South County areas of San Luis Obispo County. And obviously, the whole county knew about this case because it was, you know, so well known. I knew about it. Knew nothing specific as far as details about the case. I was just a patrol deputy. Had no clue some 30 some odd years later that 29 years later, however long it was, that I would be assigned as the lead investigator of that case. As a member of the sheriff's office here in San Luis Obispo County, everybody knew about the Kristen Smart case. It was a very, very prominent case, very well-known case that was on the news all the time. Kristen Smart's family always tried to keep the case in the media spotlight. When it happened, yeah, I was just a young patrol deputy chasing patrol calls. Yeah, so it was a Memorial Day weekend, Friday the 24th of 1996. Kristen Smart and a couple of her friends were in the dormitory, Muir Hall, and they were wanting to go out and go to a couple of parties, especially Kristen. Kristen enjoyed going to parties. She kind of was a social butterfly. She enjoyed that atmosphere. She was a freshman, so that's kind of, you know, the norm for a freshman. She wasn't anything out of the norm. It was just, you know, what freshman kids did. The campus was not at full capacity because of the holiday. So there was a, you know, a much smaller population of students on campus. Kristen and one of her friends, Margarita Campos, had gone out to a party, and it ended up being kind of a dud of a party. At the end of that party, they had just, you know, maybe two beers max each. Were not intoxicated by any stretch. As I said, the party was not really happening. It was a small party, 10 or 12 people, and it was kind of fizzling out. So Margarita and Kristen decided to leave. Margarita was more interested in going back to the dorm to study. She had some homework she wanted to work on, and Kristen once again was wanting to go find a party. So on Foothill Boulevard, not too far from what is known as Santa Rosa Street, there's kind of a railroad crossing there. They separate at that area. Margarita starts walking back to Cal Poly, which is a short distance from where they were at that intersection, to the Muir dorms. And Kristen went the other direction, and she walked up to a street called Crandall Way. And Crandall Way had a couple of houses on it. It was borders the Cal Poly campus. Crandall Way was known for a street that would usually have a party of some sort on it. You know, there were some sorority type homes and just homes where kids that lived off campus would throw parties on the weekends. So Kristen began walking up that way, and there was a party located at 135 Crandall Way, which, as I said, bordered the Cal Poly campus. Pretty short walk back to the dorms where Kristen's dorm was, Muir dorm, as well as several other dorms. So Kristen walked in, and she was, you know, a tall, blonde, pretty young lady. She was about 6 foot, 6'1". When Kristen entered the house, everyone kind of took notice. And most people that were interviewed back then and re-interviewed during my investigation said that when Kristen arrived, she was not intoxicated at any level. The party was thrown for an older crowd. It was a birthday party for a guy who was a senior at Cal Poly. So it was more older people at this party than younger people, but anyone was welcome at the party. So Kristen began, you know, socializing at the party. Witnesses saw her talking to a guy that they knew as Paul Flores. Paul Flores was also a 19-year-old freshman Cal Poly student who lived on the dorms, not very far from this Crandall Way party. So Kristen Smart's dorm, Muir, was near Paul Flores' dorm, which was Santa Lucia dorm. I would say they were no more than a couple hundred yards apart. Students saw Kristen and Paul Flores talking to each other at a bar that was in the residence. And at one point, several students saw them in a small hallway. They were talking, and at one point, something happened and they both fell to the ground. It didn't look like it was anything intentional, or, you know, that there had been any type of fight or struggle. It looked more like an accident. Quite a few people did see them fall to the ground. Paul helped Kristen back up. And at that point, Kristen was seen outside the dorm talking with another female student. Once again, that female student said that at that time, Kristen was drinking a beer, but she wasn't intoxicated. So later on, she was once again seen talking with Paul Flores. And the next time Kristen Smart is seen is around 2 o'clock in the morning when the party is breaking up and people are starting to leave. And a guy by the name of Tim and Cheryl Anderson saw Kristen laying face down in the grass off to the side of the driveway at the Crandall Way party. They described Kristen as being extremely intoxicated, passed out to the point where she could couldn't really talk or communicate. She couldn't get up on her own. She was basically passed out. This student, Tim, who was an older student, and Cheryl get Kristen up and are able to get her walking enough. Cheryl Anderson knew Kristen and knew where her dorm was. And so she volunteered to try and help Kristen get to her dorm. It was May, but it was a cool evening that morning. San Luis Obispo can get cool in the evenings, and it was definitely cool. Kristen was in shorts and a shirt, so she was freezing. And Tim decided to walk with Cheryl to get Kristen back to her dorm, and Cheryl knew where Kristen's dorm was. As Tim and Cheryl are starting to try and get Kristen walking towards the dorms, out of the blue, it was described of as coming out of the darkness off to the side of the residence. Paul Flores came over and almost over eagerly was volunteering to help get Kristen back to her dorm. So Paul walked with Tim and Cheryl, and as they got a little further away from Crandall Way, Tim asked Paul if he was okay to help get Kristen back to her dorm with Cheryl's assistance, and Paul said that he would. So Tim turned around because he had other friends at the party, and he had drove and needed to get his friends back home. So at that point, Paul Flores and Cheryl Anderson began walking with Kristen. Paul Flores has his arms around Kristen Smart, who needs support due to her intoxicated state. Several times they stopped. Paul Flores would give Kristen a hug. And interesting to everybody, especially Cheryl Anderson at the time, Paul was telling Cheryl Anderson to go ahead and leave them alone, to go ahead and move forward, that he would be responsible for getting Kristen Smart back to her dorm. Now, Paul Flores, in interviews, always said he didn't know Kristen Smart. So as I'm reviewing the case, this was very important to me, because if Paul Flores didn't know Kristen, as he said, and had no contact with her, as he said, at the party, I always wondered how he knew where to take her.
One of the people at the party, there's no doubt in their mind, said that you and Roxy fell to the floor.
I never fell to the floor.
Well, why are these people lying to us, Paul?
Mistaken.
So they continue walking. Cheryl says no, that she would stay with them. And this happens, you know, they're moving slowly. Kristen's pretty intoxicated. It's a slight uphill to where the sidewalks are, where the dorms are. And several times Paul tells Cheryl that he has this under control and to go ahead and go on to her dorm, and he would take care of the situation. Once again, Cheryl felt uncomfortable doing that. And at least once or twice, Paul also asked Cheryl Anderson for a hug, which he later denied, but Cheryl Anderson was adamant that Paul Flores asked her for a hug, and she thought that was kind of creepy and weird, so it just made her want to stay with Kristen. The three of them get up to the sidewalk. To the left would be Santa Lucia dorm and the entrance to Muir dorm, where Paul and Kristen lived. Cheryl's dorm was to the right, to the south of where they were. So at this point, Cheryl made Paul promise that he would get her to her dorm, Kristen, to her dorm in Muir Hall, which was another couple hundred yards from his dorm, Santa Lucia. So Cheryl reluctantly went ahead and left the two of them alone. At that time, Other than Paul Flores, that was the last time anybody has seen Kristen Smart alive, other than Paul Flores. Paul Flores said that he continued up to the sidewalk where his dorm was the closest to the street. And at that time, he parted ways with Kristen and said Kristen walked to her dorm, Muir dorm, on her own. While reviewing this case, I felt that was a very odd statement because Kristen was extremely intoxicated, either from alcohol or some type of drugging. I felt that it would be impossible, based on the description of witnesses, that she would be able to find her dorm on her own. And Paul's broke his word. He said he would get her to her dorm, which once again was several hundred yards away from Paul's, up another small incline. So it's pretty hard to believe that, one, Paul Flores, who we later learn is a serial rapist and drugger of women, would have a beautiful young lady all to himself near his dorm and not take advantage of her. And that was kind of my thoughts when I was reviewing the case. I just felt there was no way Kristen could have made it to her dorm by herself. And later on, we learn, you know, Paul Flores is a serial rapist. There was no way he was going to not take advantage of this situation that he found himself in with a girl that he was interested in. During interviews, later interviews, Paul Flores denied that he knew Kristen Smart, denied that he had any contact with her at the party, denied that he had any type of affection or likening of her and had never met her before. So all of these lies Paul Flores told were later dispelled by other witnesses. Paul Flores had been seen kind of chasing, flirting, talking to Kristen Smart at several parties in the months previous to the Crandall Way party. So once again, it was very difficult to believe that Paul Flores was going to just let Kristen Smart walk away, especially when she wasn't really capable of walking away. Paul Flores says Kristen, to his knowledge, made it to her dorm, and as far as he knew, she was safe, and he went into his dorm. He said when he got one statement that I always thought was very suspicious. Paul Flores was asked what he did when he got back to the dorm, his dorm. And he said something that always stood out to me. And that was, when we got back to my dorm, I threw up a little bit in my mouth. Now, what I thought was interesting is he tells investigators that he had let Kristen go by herself. But yet he then now is saying, when we got back to the dorm, that tells me that he arrived with somebody, and the most likely pretty much only person that could be is Kristen Smart. Paul Flores then tells investigators that he went to sleep. And when he threw up in his mouth, he had gone into the bathroom of the dormitory to brush his teeth, which also seemed odd. During this time, he hears a door, like somebody else entered the bathroom. And he thought he had been seen. So that is why I believe he is offering this information to investigators. Investigators had no idea that Paul had gone to the bathroom. And there was really no reason for him to say so, except in my mind, he felt he may have been seen in the bathroom and was worried about a witness coming forward. So, you know, what was Paul Flores doing in the bathroom? It seems kind of odd that if he threw up in his mouth, he was going to go and brush his teeth at that moment. But that was his story. And then he said that he woke up later in the morning, called his dad at approximately 9 a.m. Saturday morning. His dad came to get him, and he spent the rest of the weekend at his dad's house. Paul Flores was last seen by Cheryl Anderson at approximately 2:30. That is confirmed. The story about the bathroom is unconfirmed and unknown whether that's the truth or one of Paul Flores' many lies during this investigation. So from basically 2:30 in the morning until 6 p.m., that Saturday, Paul Flores is unaccounted for. He was never really asked where he was at or what he was doing other than at his dad's house in Arroyo Grande, which was about a 20-25 minute drive from Cal Poly. There are phone records showing Paul Flores did call his father about 9 a.m., but Paul Flores is basically, his whereabouts are unknown until about 6 to 6:30 p.m., where he meets a couple of friends in the dinner hall at Cal Poly on the Cal Poly campus. And that is confirmed by those two witnesses. So there's a long period of time where Paul Flores's whereabouts are unaccounted for. When Margarita woke up, she went over to Kristen Smart's dormitory and found that Kristen Smart was not in her dorm, but her roommate was. And so they talked and they were like trying to figure out what could have happened to Kristen. Margarita tells the story that, you know, she and Kristen Smart had separated earlier in the evening. And Margarita notices something unusual, that Kristen Smart's purse, handbag, her backpack with a lot of her personal effects, things that had, if she had changed her mind and wanted to go somewhere for the weekend, she would have taken these items. We're talking toiletries, makeup, those sorts of things. Key, all that stuff was laying on Kristen Smart's dorm bed. That was very unusual for Kristen. If Kristen was going to stay the night or go out of town, she would have told her friends, especially Margarita. Her and Margarita had plans to study on Saturday in the dormitory because they both had exams coming up. It was coming to the end of the quarter at Cal Poly. And so all of the students had finals.
When Kristen's roommates first reported or first attempted to report that she was missing, they were told that to basically not worry about it, that Kristen was probably on a Memorial Day weekend trip. And officers essentially brushed off that these roommates were worried about their friend.
Cal Poly police decide that Kristen hasn't been missing long enough and they don't send an officer at that time. So as the day wears on, we're getting into the evening hours. Kristen's friends are now very scared, very worried that something has happened to Kristen because it just was not normal for her to not show up, especially when she had plans. So they called Kristen's parents and were told that Kristen did not go home. You know, they thought, well, maybe she decided to go home. That was dispelled very quickly. The parents said, no, we haven't heard from her. And we were expecting a phone call from her. And that phone call, as of the time friends were reaching out, had never happened from Kristen. So Cal Poly police are called. Once again, there's really not much response. So her friends continue to worry and they called the San Luis Obispo Police Department. So it's a unique situation where Cal Poly campus has its own police department. It's a small police department, you know, handful of officers and other staff that their primary responsibility is just patrolling, taking calls for service on the Cal Poly campus. Cal Poly campus is in the city of San Luis Obispo, which has its own police department. But unless there was an emergency, they don't share jurisdiction. Each agency is different. And Cal Poly handles everything that occurs on the Cal Poly campus, thefts, sexual assaults, you name it, whatever it is. So San Luis Obispo police tell Kristen's friends, now we're into the evening, that, you know, it's nothing, there's nothing they can do because this is a Cal Poly Police Department problem. So another day goes by. Kristen Smart's mother, Denise, is now gravely concerned. There was a rumor of some sort that somehow got started that Kristen was going to go camping with friends, yet that was not the truth. That was never validated. There was never any plans for Kristen to go camping. Yet Cal Poly police used that. And I'm not trying to disparage Cal Poly police. I'm just stating facts. The police department just kind of used this supposed camping trip, wherever it came from, as a reason not to respond and take a report, not to go look in Kristen's dorm, not to try and find out the last person she was with. So as time goes on, people are starting to realize the last person that Kristen was seen with was Paul Flores. Well, Paul had a little bit of a reputation on campus. There were some people who called him Creepy Paul. He had a reputation as being an awkward person, especially around girls. He had been known to be aggressive to girls, especially at parties. And the word is spreading a little bit around campus that Paul helped walk Kristen back home. So now we're getting into Monday. Cal Poly police, because they keep getting calls from Kristen's friends, actually call Stan and Denise Smart, Kristen's parents, at home in Stockton, and ask them if they had seen or heard from Kristen or if Kristen came home. And Denise immediately told them no, that she did not come home. And she expressed great fear that something was terribly wrong, that it was not like Kristen. Kristen was supposed to call them Sunday evening with some very good news, which we later found out was Kristen was able to get a class that she was struggling in changed. And she wanted to tell her parents that. That phone call never happened on Sunday. So Denise, you know, thankfully, starts really kind of wreaking havoc and you know, demanding something be done. So interestingly enough, none of this was ever brought into court, but I always found very interesting was when Cal Poly called Denise Smart, law enforcement phone lines are usually recorded. The phone call is recorded and it's in the case file. When they hang up from Denise, there's a hot mic and you can hear them talking. They're discussing the situation and it's just very obvious that there was no concern by the police department. They do eventually send an officer out to the dorm, I believe on Sunday, but that officer really doesn't do anything. Once again, doesn't do any type of investigation. He basically boils it down to she hasn't been missing long enough. Denise Smart and Stan Smart, her parent, Kristen's parents, continue to make phone calls and demand some action. And Stan Smart starts making plans to come to San Luis Obispo to start looking for Kristen. Eventually, on Tuesday morning, Cal Poly police do send a patrol officer out to do an investigation. And he begins by speaking with Kristen's roommates. He notices Kristen's things are still on her bed. He does speak to Paul Flores briefly. Paul Flores admits to helping walk Kristen Smart home. And then that officer leaves. And later that day, Cal Poly had an investigator. He gets involved and they once again talk to Paul Flores. One of the things they say initially to Paul is, you know, you're not a suspect, which even if they felt he wasn't, I wish they wouldn't have said that, because that can put someone at ease, you know. And what we know now is Paul Flores was definitely the suspect in this murder. And so they kind of gave him a free pass to relax, in my opinion. They interviewed him once in the dorm, his dorm. They didn't search it. They just noticed, they made some notes that there wasn't really nothing obvious, but there was no search. There was no taking of any evidence, any bedding, any clothing. Paul Flores usually wore a Baltimore Orioles hat. Nothing was taken at that time. So the case ends up continuing to be investigated. There are people, you know, calling in sightings of seeing Kristen all over the state. Eventually, the San Luis Obispo County District Attorney's Office is brought in to assist. That's not uncommon for small agencies to ask for district attorney's office who has investigators who have more experience in these types of cases, homicides, missing persons cases, than Cal Poly police did. And so they start getting involved. There was in Paul's dorm, which was room number 128 in Santa Lucia dorm, there was a window that opened up to a back parking lot. The window was about a school desk high. There's actually pictures in the case file of this window, and it's the same height as a desk, which is sitting in front of the window. And that window would open up out into the parking lot behind Paul's dorm room, where there was also a dumpster nearby. So investigators initially thought maybe Paul Flores put Kristen into the dumpster. So a very large scale search of the dump site was done over a period of several days with negative results. They backtracked where the trash was dumped from Cal Poly during this time frame. They kept track of all of that, and they did a huge search and found nothing related to the case.
It took a few days for police to actually start treating this as a missing persons case. And by the time they started treating it as a missing persons case, it was kind of too late. Paul's dorm room was already completely cleaned out by the cleaning services that the campus provides. They never treated Kristen's dorm or Paul's dorm as a crime scene. So there was a lot of evidence that was lost. A big theory why Paul was able to essentially stay out for so long and not be arrested earlier is a lot of people believe that it's due to the way the campus police handled the missing persons case from the beginning.
Hey, Paul, do you have any information on that missing girl? What'd you do with her?
When he is interviewed by Cal Poly investigators, they notice that Paul has a black eye. And they also notice scratches on his knees. They ask Paul where he got the black eye, and he says that He was playing basketball with a friend of his named Jeremy, and he got elbowed in the face, and that's how he got the black eye. He also said that during that basketball game, he fell because there was some sand or stuff on the basketball court. Unfortunately, investigators didn't take any photographs of these injuries to Paul Flores. Paul Flores stays at his father's house. The phone call to Ruben Flores was made on Sunday a.m. His father, Ruben, picks him up Sunday morning at 9 a.m. And Paul goes to Ruben's house where he stays and hangs out with his friend, Jeremy Moon. Paul also has a pickup truck that belonged to him. That was a Ford Ranger. His parents had bought that for him, but they had taken it from Paul because he had gotten a DUI. It had been towed and stored. And so as punishment, Paul's truck was not on campus that night. It was at his father's house in Arroyo Grande. So Paul had no vehicle access to him the night that Kristen went missing. So to dispose of her remains or to do something with her, he would have, in my opinion, had to have called for help from somebody. You know, the most likely would be his family. Paul's Flores' sister, Irma Linda, lived approximately 1 mile from the campus in a small house. And that's where Paul was actually headed the night that he located the Crandall Way party. In a kind of a weird twist of fate, Paul Flores did not take care of his suspended license ticket, so he had a warrant issued for his arrest for driving on a suspended license. The Arroyo Grande Police Department show up to Ruben Flores' house where Paul Flores was at Memorial Day weekend and ask if Paul is available to take care of this warrant, post a small amount of bail, basically go down to the station, get fingerprinted, picture taken. And Ruben tells him that Paul was out. He was out at the movies with his friend Jeremy. But when they got back, Ruben Flores would immediately bring Paul Flores down to the Arroyo Grande police station to take care of this misdemeanor warrant. And when Paul returned, that's exactly what they did. So interestingly enough, as uncooperative as the Flores family has been in the murder of Kristen Smart, they were very willing to be cooperative on a warrant where he would get arrested and released. So it's interesting to me that they, even though there's a big difference between murder and suspended driver's license, they're willing to cooperate on something like that. But to this day, almost 30 years later, they're still uncooperative in where the remains of Kristen Smart are being hid by the Flores family. So Paul goes down. He gets booked and released, just like the Arroyo Grande Police Department said. And luckily, they took a booking photo of him, which was the only picture that we had of his black eye. So on June 19th, 1996, Kristen Smart is still missing. Absolutely no sign of her. We're talking a couple of weeks now and nothing. So highly unusual. All of her stuff was left in the dorm. You know, at this point, I believe investigators realize something terrible has happened. And I believe they think that Paul Flores is the terrible that happened to Kristen. Two DA district attorney investigators interview Paul on June 19th, 1996. And that interview was videotaped at the Arroyo Grande Police Department. In this interview, Paul Flores is voluntarily brought to the Arroyo Grande Police Station. It's an interview of about 2.5 hours. And the first time that I watched the interview after I was assigned the case, it was very obvious to me that Paul Flores was involved in the murder of Kristen Smart. His behavior, his body language, the multiple lies that he was telling. The investigators do a good job of developing a timeline for Paul as best they could. But the most important thing that they did was ask Paul about where he got the black eye.
Now, one thing that really does look bad, and I don't know if you want to discuss this now, but we might as well, that we need to really get cleared up is, last time we talked to you, you had a black eye.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
Okay. And what did you tell us?
I told you I got it playing basketball.
That's right.
The DA investigators had already talked to his friend Jeremy. And Jeremy was adamant that Paul Flores didn't get that black eye playing basketball. Jeremy was with him. There was no elbow to the face. There was no fall, nothing that Paul Flores had told Cal Poly investigators weeks earlier was the truth. And so when they tell Paul Flores that his own friend, what Jeremy said about the black eye, Paul then tells investigators, well, he must have got it by working on his truck.
Where did you get it?
In my car.
What car?
My Ranger.
Ranger? And when did it happen?
On Memorial Day or Labor Day, whatever it was.
Monday?
Yeah. Happened about 2 o'clock in the morning.
Why 2 in the morning?
Because I was uninstalling my radio because I'm selling my truck. Mm-hmm.
And where were you working on your car?
In my garage.
Garage? And how did you get the black eye?
I hit the steering wheel. That's about it. But like, how often do people hit their eye in the steering wheel? So
I don't know.
See, it was like right here. So then I went like that, popped up. And
when Paul Flores' truck was being stored at his father's house, there was an issue with the stereo system. Paul had put in it, the stereo system wouldn't shut off, so it would drain the battery. So Ruben asked Paul to work on it, take it out, and fix it so that the battery wouldn't run dead all the time on the pickup truck. So Paul's first story is when he got there Sunday, he stayed up most of the night working on the stereo in his truck, which doesn't make a lot of sense. Having worked on stereos, especially back in the 90s when they were much simpler than they are now, there's not a lot to them to disconnect the wires from the speakers and that sort of thing. Paul tells investigators that he may have got the black eye by hitting his face on a steering wheel and hit the steering wheel of his pickup truck while working on the stereo. So now we have a second story that Paul has told investigators in a short amount of time on how he got the bruise.
Oh, it's not really lies, the fib. It's so minute. It's not, well, I guess you can call it like a little white lie.
How you got your black eye? It's a white lie?
Yep.
During that interview, Paul asked to leave several times. It's obvious that he's very uncomfortable in the interview room. He tells investigators that he has to go home to his mom's house, which is just down the street from the police department, to, quote, clean up concrete dust. So that sparked a lot of interest. Paul's mother, Susan Flores' residence, had concrete poured in the backyard of the residence prior to Kristen Smart going missing. At some point before or just after Kristen going missing, there is somebody who cuts the concrete to make planter boxes in that backyard. When Paul Flores says this, everybody just automatically assumes that they did this to bury Kristen in the concrete. And that was kind of what a lot of people, not necessarily the investigators, but a lot of other outside people who were privately investigating this case ran with that theory that Kristen was at Susan Flores' house on Branch Street in Arroyo Grande. And while reading the case, you know, I developed a theory that she most likely wasn't, nor was she ever at Branch Street. I felt the most likely place that she would have been buried at would have been Paul's father's house, Ruben Flores, who lived on a street, White Court, which is much more secluded. Susan's house is right on Branch Street, which is a very busy street. It's rarely not got traffic going by it. A very busy street. And so, you know, even in the middle of the night, this house, which sits right on the sidewalk of Branch Street, it would have been hard to bury a body, cut concrete, all this stuff in the middle of the night. There's homes that sit above Susan Flores' home that have windows. It just didn't seem like a good spot to me. But when I looked at Ruben Flores' house, it seemed like an excellent spot. Ruben Flores had a very large deck in the backyard, which was very tall. In some places, it was 6 or 7 feet tall. You could walk underneath the deck. If you drove up to White Court, there's a cul-de-sac, and when you rounded the cul-de-sac and came back down to go back away from Ruben Flores' house, you could look down in his backyard, and there were places where you couldn't see into the backyard because his house sat down and the road was up above. And so I just felt it was a very good place if you were going to need to bury a body very quickly. This would have been a good spot. And it worked in the Flores family's favor that everybody focused on Susan Flores' house. The sheriff's office eventually takes over the case from Cal Poly Police at the request of Cal Poly Police on around July 22nd of 1996. Cal Poly realized that they didn't have as many resources as the sheriff's office did. Sheriff's office had a lot more officers and experience. Nothing against Cal Poly. There aren't a lot of murders on the Cal Poly campus. And so they didn't have a lot of experience handling homicide cases. So once the sheriff's office takes the case over, they do author a search warrant for Ruben Flores' house. And that search warrant authorized searching the exterior, interior of the residence for items of evidence. The only thing that Kristen Smart had in her possession, and it's not 100% sure that she had it, but the only thing that she would have had in her possession the night she went to the Crandall party was a key to get back into the dorm, which was on a keychain that had a surfboard, a little mini surfboard on it. So investigators had the authority to search the entire residence looking for that. They could have looked underneath the deck. They could have looked exterior, the whole property. Really all they did, and they videotaped their presence inside, was search. They really didn't search anything. They did take some newspaper articles that they found underneath Paul's mattress in his bedroom. And Ruben had some newspaper articles about the case. And Ruben Flores, who used to be a reserve deputy or a reserve police officer down in LA County, had a a baton. Well, it's illegal for people who are not peace officers to carry this baton, so they seized that. But they really didn't take anything else. Later, reading the case, Paul's bedding was in boxes from the dorm in the garage at Ruben's place on White Court. When they videotaped going through the house, you could see boxes in Paul's room of all of Paul's belongings from the dorm. During the videotape of the search warrant, Paul Flores is wearing the Baltimore Orioles cap that he was wearing the night that he killed Kristen Smart. And none of those items were taken or seized. It was never inactive. It was always active, but it just never really got anywhere. They did focus on Paul Flores as the primary suspect. In 1999, they did a wiretap on the Flores family. Not much came from that. The Flores family, for a family that's innocent, they are very wise. They know not to talk on the phone. They know that they know how law enforcement stimulates a wiretap to try and get suspects to talk. And anytime there was any type of stimulation, the Flores family would all meet in the parking lot of grocery stores, other stores, to talk in person. They knew not to talk on the phone. So I always thought, well, that's really not what innocent people do. Innocent people aren't being smart enough to meet in person because they're worried about what they might say on a telephone conversation in case the law enforcement is recording it. So there's so many circumstantial things pointing to the Flores family throughout this case, but it just never could really make any headway. Going back to, 1996, 1997, before Paul Flores moved out of San Luis Obispo County, he worked at a local 76 gas station in Pismo Beach. And at one point, the Smarts drove up to the gas station in an attempt to talk to Paul Flores. And Paul Flores ran back into the gas station and refused to talk to them. There was another occasion where Stan Smart, who spent years looking for his daughter, it's the saddest thing in the world, where this man would take time off from work and come down here and look for his daughter all over San Luis Obispo County and talk to anyone who would talk to him. Well, at one point he was frustrated and he pulled up to White Court where Ruben lives, and he stayed in the street, didn't violate any laws, was not on Ruben's property. He pulled up, parked in the center of the cul-de-sac, got out of his truck, stayed. So his driver's side door would have been on the furthest side from Ruben's house. So there was a car, some street, and a sidewalk, and Ruben was down in his carport area. And Stan just, desperate, just asked Ruben to talk to him. Not being aggressive, just begging for, some conversation and, just trying to maybe get Ruben to tell where his daughter was at and, maybe they could work something out. Ruben became very hostile and made some sort of comment that if Stan didn't get out of there, somebody could get shot. And so Stan obviously took that pretty seriously, got in his vehicle and left. Paul Flores eventually, shortly after the investigation on him, he moves down to Orange County area with his sister. One thing I always thought was interesting is his sister quit talking to law enforcement long before Paul or the rest of the family did. And I think that's because Paul Flores went to her house the night he killed Kristen to call his father, Ruben. Those phone records were never obtained. And so by the time somebody thought about it a while later, the records had been purged. So, but the most likely way Paul Flores could have called for help was going to his sister's house a mile away. Because the dorm phone records were obtained and Paul Flores made no phone calls to his sister except for before the party. He called his sister, who did not answer, to tell her that he was going to come to her house, but she didn't answer. So he grabbed a couple of beers and started towards his sister's house when he found the Crandall Way party. So the dorm phone records were seized. And we do know that Paul Flores called his father Sunday morning at 9 a.m. and called his sister Friday night about 7:30 before he headed to the Crandall Way party. The sister's phone records, Ruben's phone records, were never seized or obtained. And so those were purged and we were never able to access them. What I think happened is he calls his dad at 2:30 in the morning. They go bury Kristen, and then they come up with this plan. Take Paul back to Cal Poly. Okay, now call me, and I will come and get you where you will stay the rest of the weekend at my house. Because that was their plan prior to him killing Kristen. And I need to clarify that. We know that Paul Flores called Ruben from his dorm phone on Saturday at 9 a.m. to come pick him up. And that was confirmed by both Ruben and Paul Flores in depositions and interviews. And that was the plan, that Paul was going to stay at Cal Poly Friday and Ruben was going to come and get him Saturday. So Paul is basically unaccounted for from 9 a.m. Saturday, because he and Ruben do confirm that Ruben picked him up. And there is a phone call from Paul to Ruben just prior to that from the dorm room. So Paul's whereabouts are unconfirmed from 9 a.m. until 6:30 p.m. that same Saturday, when he meets friends in the dining hall on Cal Poly's campus. So what I believe happened is when Paul Flores killed Kristen Smart in his dorm early Saturday morning, when, quote, we arrived back at the dorm, he then ran down to his sister's house where he called his father, Ruben. For some reason, he didn't want to use the dorm phone, probably because he knew the dorm phones were monitored and more closely, and it was less likely, and it turned out to be true, that law enforcement would get phone records from his sister, because those records were never obtained. So that's what I believe Paul did, was run down to his sister's house, which would have taken no more than 10 to 15 minutes, calls Ruben for help. Susan Flores told a work partner later on that Ruben did leave the house after getting a phone call that Saturday morning, but she doesn't know what else happened. Now, the lady that Susan told that to could not remember that 25 years later, but a friend of hers did. However, none of that can be used in court because of the hearsay rule. So that's what I believe happened. Is Paul ran to his sister's, called for help. His sister knows what happened. That's why she moved out of the area almost immediately down to Orange County. She quit talking to law enforcement. She's been more uncooperative than anybody in the case. The only reason I can try to understand that is she knows what happened and she doesn't want to get involved. So law enforcement also at the time did not obtain any phone records from Ruben's house. So the only phone records that were obtained, because Cal Poly kept them because the students had to pay for all those phone calls, Cal Poly did keep phone call records of that, of the dorm. And so phone call records from Kristen's dorm, which there were none, and from Paul's dorm were obtained and were in the file and used in evidence. But no phone records were ever attempted or seized on Ruben or his sister Irma Linda's house, who lived in San Luis Obispo. So those phone records do not exist.
In 2016, investigators in the Kristen Smart case began excavating sites on a hillside near the Cal Poly P, saying a new lead strongly suggests the former Cal Poly freshman's remains may be buried there. The FBI used backhoes and loaders and teams of individuals hand-sifting the dirt in an effort to find any evidence related to Smart or her disappearance. Items of interest were said to have been located at these sites on the hillside, but as of today, no specifics or new updates have been announced.
Case continued to be investigated. There was never an arrest made. And, you know, that's a very valid, frequently asked question. Because when I got the case, we didn't gain a whole lot more. We got a couple of statements from Susan on a wiretap, but for the most part, everything that we used in court to convict Paul Flores, they had since day one. And a lot of what was used was Paul's lies. You know, there were plea agreement discussions talked about between Paul's attorney and the DA's office, which were in the file, but none of that could ever be used. That was really the most, I guess, promising thing they had, was why would you have your attorney talk to the DA's office about a potential plea agreement if you didn't do anything? But that can't be used against you. That's not evidence. So it's hard to say why they didn't go ahead and make an arrest. On one hand, I understand, you know, it's difficult to prosecute a no-body homicide. It's extremely difficult. It takes a special prosecutor to do something like that. And so when I got the case, I looked at everything, the lies Paul told. There was an undercover operation by the FBI where Paul makes some incriminating statements. He had always told investigators he didn't fall to the floor with Kristen at the Crandall Way house. He clearly tells an undercover agent that he lied about that, and he did fall to the floor with her. All of that was available. I don't know why nobody was willing. It's both a law enforcement and a prosecutor issue. No one was really willing to take the case on with nothing but circumstantial evidence. I looked at everything that we had, and I believed that there was plenty of circumstantial evidence. You know, nowadays, a lot of people think that we have to have DNA and, you know, and cell phone technology, and that's all great stuff. But I kind of looked at it as, hey, there's no other logical explanation in this case. It's been 25, 26 years. Kristen Smart has missed her brother and sister's weddings, all of their kids' birthdays, her own birthday, her parents' birthdays. She's missed all kinds of family events, vacations. This is a super tight, close-knit family. I believe Kristen Smart was murdered by Paul Flores, and it was time that we take it to a court.
Tonight, there's been a major break in a 25-year-old mystery. A father and son are now in custody in connection with a 1996 disappearance and murder of college student Kristen Smart. Paul Flores has long been the prime suspect. Police say Flores, a college classmate, walked her home from a frat party in California. His father is accused of being an accessory after the fact. Police have searched his property in recent weeks, but Smart's body has never been found.
You know, by the grace of God or good luck, whatever you want to call it, there was a prosecutor in San Luis Obispo County for the DA's office named Chris Provell. And Chris and I were buddies. We had worked another homicide recently together. And we wrote a 35-page document outlining all the circumstantial evidence in the case. And I let Chris Provell read it. And Chris felt that he could prosecute the case. Prior to Chris and I, no one was willing, it seemed, to take on the chance of losing. You know, there's no other explanation for what happened to Kristen. We had served search warrants. We did a wiretap in 2020 on the Flores family house. There was a podcast going called Your Own Backyard by an individual by the name of Chris that was raising the popularity of this case to an incredible amount. I mean, the national, international fame of this case caused by that podcast was incredible. It also brought forward some new witnesses. A lot of times people are afraid to talk to law enforcement, but they can talk to a podcaster because the podcaster can keep them confidential. If you talk to me, you're going to end up in a courtroom. At the same time, we were doing a wiretap where Susan Flores, who was listening to the podcast, told Paul Flores in a phone call we recorded that she needed Paul to listen to the podcast and poke holes in his story. If Paul could, referring to Paul poking holes in the podcast story, and then she says, only you know that.
The other thing I needed to do is to start listening to the podcast. I need you to listen to everything they say so we could punch holes in it. Wherever we can punch holes, maybe we can't. You're the one that can tell me.
So when I heard that, I mean, to me, I look at things probably a little more aggressively, positively than a lot of prosecutors would. But, you know, I provided that information to Chris, and almost immediately that tells me the only reason she's asking Paul to poke holes in the story is because Paul knows the story. I mean, why else? I mean, to me, it wasn't a confession by any stretch, but it's getting there, you know, where it's certainly, in my opinion, telling us that Susan Flores knows that Paul Flores knows what happened to Kristen Smart. And she's asking him to poke holes in the story because at this same time, she's hired attorneys for everybody. And she's wanting information to provide to these attorneys. And so with all of that, some new information, in the wiretap, and we got some new witnesses to come forward. A roommate of Ruben Flores's came forward and said that Ruben Flores would not let anybody under the deck. No one was allowed in the backyard. An ex-girlfriend of Paul Flores's came forward and said she came to visit Ruben Flores's house with Paul Flores years ago when they were dating and was not allowed in the backyard by the avocado trees. Ruben had been storing Irma Linda's car, a Volkswagen convertible, all these years in his garage. That car is not considered an antique car. It was just collecting dust and things sitting on it in Ruben's garage when we served search warrants there. And one of Ruben's neighbors offered to buy the car, and Ruben said the car is not for sale. So that was very suspicious. So I was able to talk to Chris about all of this stuff. And Chris is a great prosecutor and felt that he could take the case on. And, you know, as far as why nobody else did before, I don't know. I always felt there was enough circumstantially. And then we gathered a little bit more. And when we served some search warrants on everybody's house after the wiretap, we located evidence. Paul had been recording himself raping unconscious women. He had saved these things on hard drives and on phones. And so we went back and served another warrant, hoping to find more evidence on those types of cases. Now, most of these rapes occurred in Los Angeles County's jurisdiction, not ours. So we began cooperating with the Los Angeles Police Department and District Attorney's Office to try and get them to look into these rapes that had occurred in over a period of 10 or 12 years by Paul Flores in LA County. With that new information, we felt that we had enough to go forward. Ultimately, you know, it's the decision of the elected district attorney to decide whether to file charges. And that was quite a hurdle, but we were able to get the district attorney to agree to let Chris Prevail file charges on this case. And I firmly believe the only prosecutor in San Luis Obispo County that could have prosecuted this case and won it is Chris Prevail. And I'll always, you know, be in awe of how he prosecuted and handled this case. It's just an incredible job by an incredible prosecutor. This case had an unusual twist to it. It was decided that there would be two jurors because we arrested Ruben Flores for accessory after the fact for having Kristen Smart's body under his deck. We believe there was circumstantial evidence that showed that in a search warrant. We found blood 4 feet down in a hole 6 feet by 4 feet. We found staining consistent with human decomposition. And we also found clothing with the same color consistent of with the clothing Kristen was wearing. This is all 4 feet down. And so we took soil samples, took them up to a lab in Richmond, California, and they determined there was human blood in that soil. The only thing that could be besides human blood would be that of a ferret or a monkey. And there was obviously neither a ferret or a monkey buried underneath Ruben's deck.
They found what they believe is a clandestine grave that was empty but had evidence of human body decomposition. So inside that clandestine grave, there was a bathtub ring that was dark in color that the prosecution believes, and they had expert witnesses say, were evidence of human body decomposition. There was also a blood test done in that soil ring that occurred. And that blood test was positive for human blood as well, according to testimony shown at trial. So when the prosecution was first showing evidence underneath Ruben Flores' deck of the grave, they had an expert testimony from Cindy Arrington, who was testifying about what the dark bathtub ring was. And she was testifying that it was, when she testified that that bathtub ring was evidence of human body decomposition, one of the jurors began wailing during and had a really strong emotional reaction to the evidence, to the point where the judge called a recess and called everybody to break, and the juror was really crying. And that juror said that that was the first time she thought that maybe Paul Flores did kill Kristen.
We attempted to test that blood with DNA to try and confirm that it was in fact Kristen Smart's. However, it was too degraded to get DNA from. You have to keep in mind, it was in the ground for over 25 years. This was a sandy soil. So water would go through it a lot. It was 100% human blood, but we could not get any DNA results due to the age of the blood. So that was a frustrating part. We were really hoping to prove that it was Kristen, but still felt very comfortable circumstantially that we had enough that it was Kristen Smart. We had a witness who, after we served search warrants on February 5th of 2020, on February 9th and 10th, saw Susan Flores and her boyfriend, Mike McConville, at Ruben Flores' house all night with a trailer parked on the side of the house, doing something in the backyard where we found this, where we later found this hole, anomaly, using GPR, which we believe was the burial, initial burial site of Kristen Smart. And I believe that on February 9th and 10th, and possibly through the 11th, the Flores family moved Kristen Smart's remains from underneath Ruben's deck and has placed them somewhere else. We seized that trailer that they had on the side. It's a cargo trailer, totally enclosed. On the front right has a single 36-inch door, which, the way the trailer was parked, is impossible to see it from the road. It was completely blocked from anybody to see what was going on that side of the trailer and in front of the trailer where Kristen's burial site was. We did a thing called Blue Star, which is similar to luminol, which some people more are aware of. But Blue Star is the same as luminol, just a different product. And it fluoresces under certain substances, such as body fluids, but it will also fluoresce with cleaning substances, such as Clorox-type cleaning. So inside that trailer, just inside that front door, in a shape that almost looks like a person laying on their side, was a very bright blue star reaction that fluoresced. And in the middle of that blue star fluorescent reaction was the DNA of Mike McConville, Susan Flores' boyfriend. And what I believe happened is they put Kristen, who was most likely wrapped in something, into that trailer and moved her. And Mike was tasked with cleaning that area from the sand and such that would have been on the body as they moved it. His DNA, most likely from a hand down on the plywood, was in the center of this fluoresced site. When we found that blue star reaction in the trailer, I wrote a search warrant for the DNA of Ruben and Susan Flores and Mike McConville, to see if, in fact, their DNA was anywhere near this blue star reaction. Ruben had an attorney at the time, as well as Susan and Mike had attorney. And so I called the attorney, did the proper thing, gave Ruben plenty of notice. I let the attorney see the warrant, and he called Ruben. Ruben had several hours notice, so there was not a surprise by us. We didn't just show up. But DA investigator J.T. Camp and I, who was assisting on the case, went to Ruben's house and collected his DNA with a buccal swab, which is basically just a long Q-tip. And I let Ruben read the search warrant because he's allowed to have a copy of it. And he's reading it, and he sees his name. And I put all three names so we don't have to write three warrants. It's just, you know, to expedite things. And he sees Susan and Mike's name. And he says, "I don't understand why you're swabbing them. They didn't commit a felony, only I did. I mean, only I got arrested." So I was recording that, and that was played in court. We had a unique situation where each Ruben and Paul, who were charged, Paul was charged with murder during the commission of a rape or attempted rape, and Ruben Flores was charged with accessory after the fact. And so in this case, one of the reasons Ruben was eventually found not guilty was that jury, Ruben's jury, did hear his confession about committing a felony, but they also did not hear the portion of Paul's interview with the DA investigators, which provided vital information to Paul's involvement. So if you're not sure Paul's involved because you didn't get to see all of Paul's evidence, they decided that there wasn't enough evidence to convict Ruben, even though he admitted to committing a felony.
A juror I spoke to for Ruben actually believed that there wasn't enough evidence to convict Paul. So he actually called me the day after the trial, or the day after the verdicts were read, and said that Paul Flores' jury got it wrong, that he did not believe that Paul Flores did it, or at minimum, there wasn't enough evidence to convict him. But the consensus from Paul Flores' jury, at least the jurors that I spoke with, was they believed that Paul raped and killed Kristen that night. And they said that the biggest pieces of evidence for them were the deck, the soil staining under the deck. And then also the main one really was the two women who testified and said Paul Flores drugged and raped them. They said that those two women's testimonies showed a pattern of behavior, and they believe that Kristen was part of that pattern of behavior, maybe towards the beginning of when that behavior began.
Win or lose, I knew we were prosecuting the right person. There's not a doubt in my mind. And unfortunately, Ruben Flores' jury acquitted him. They didn't get to see all of the evidence, such as Paul's interview. They did get to hear Ruben admit to me that he committed a felony while I was swabbing him, but they still didn't think that was enough. So I respect the jury's decision. I disagree with it 100%, but I respect it. But with all of that, when you put in so much work to get the truth, and it is the truth that Paul Flores murdered Kristen Smart. When you hear those words, guilty of first degree murder and the commission of a rape or attempted rape, all of that work prior to hearing that makes it all well worth it. Seeing Paul's reaction, he didn't react because he's guilty. You know, I've seen innocent people in interviews and they react a certain way. Paul Flores acted like a guilty man when they read the guilty verdict. Do 100% believe Ruben Flores was guilty and is guilty of assisting hide the body, and probably still is assisting in hiding Kristen's body. And that's the frustrating part when you have, the law and two juries and two suspects. Not Ruben's jury didn't get to hear all of the evidence that was presented showing Paul's guilt. I retired on March 10th, 2023, the day Paul Flores was sentenced to 25 years to life. And yes, that was planned. I took a year off because the case was grueling, was hard on me, and I came back as a part-time reserve deputy now because the case is continuing to be investigated. So what's being investigated is trying to bring Kristen Smart home to her parents and her family. I took some time off to get kind of myself square, and the Sheriff Ian Parkinson has dedicated any resource still to this day that we need to help try and locate the remains of Kristen Smart.
Without Kristen, there is no joy or happiness in this verdict. After 26 years with today's split verdicts, we learned that our quest for justice for Kristen will continue. This has been an agonizingly long journey with more downs than ups, but we are grateful and appreciate the diligence and energy of the two juries to thoroughly review the facts and reach their decisions. Our faith in the justice system has been renewed by their commitment and effort.
My relationship with the Smarts is good. We talk a lot. I keep them updated on our investigation. This case is still actively being investigated, looking for Kristen Smart's body. As rewarding as it was for us and for the Smart family to know Paul Flores is in prison, the case isn't over. It's certainly not over for the Smart family. You know, I can't imagine being in their position where all it takes is for a family to just give it up. Just have enough heart to just give up the body. Paul's not going to get out of prison unless that body comes forward. Give the body up. People swore we'd never convict Paul Flores without the body. Just like people are saying, people tell me, you'll never find Kristen without the Flores' help. Well, they told me we wouldn't convict Paul either. So don't count us out, Flores's. We're still looking. And if we find the body without your help, things are going to be a lot worse than if they were to just bring the body, come forward. Things could be so much better. And that's got to be so, just such a horrible feeling for the Smart family. Well, I know it is. I speak to them. You know, Denise Smart, she aches to get her daughter back. I mean, it's only right. It's bad enough what they've gone through all these years. So it's not over. I communicate with the Smart family at least every 2 weeks or so. And when I say this case is active in regards to locating Kristen Smart, it is very, very active. It's just as active as before Paul Flores was convicted.
What did this do to your life? And where are you now at in life? If you want to touch on that. If you don't, all good. However you want to do it, but.
Yeah, no. So at the conclusion of the trial, when Paul Flores was found guilty, there was obvious some relief happiness for the Smart family. However, this case was a very difficult case. There was so much notoriety, so much pressure. There were a lot of things that went on behind the scenes that I can never even talk about publicly that created a large amount of stress and anxiety for me and others, but especially me. And the reason I retired a little early, this case was so difficult that I developed an alcohol problem. And I don't want, you know, it took a toll on my life. And I wouldn't take it back. I would do it all over again for the Smarts. But it took a very large toll on me, my anxiety, stress level. And so I took a year off. And during that year that I took off, I got myself fixed. And I just think it's important for anybody that struggles in law enforcement with substance abuse issues, alcohol, that it can get better. And I am doing great now. I no longer drink alcohol. My mind is strong, and I'm back working on this case, and it's so much different now that my mind is straight, that it's easier, and this case is gonna continue until we find Kristen Smart, and that's a promise to the Flores family. We will not stop. And I'm just glad that that I was able to have some resources to get myself back together so that I could come back and do the job that I love to do.